Are you a guitar maker, perhaps? Just a woodworker? Maybe just a gardener? Then you should know about Lee Valley. Lee Valley is widely known for supplying artisans with some of the best woodworking tools imaginable. And now they're in the luthery tool business. They have nearly everything you would need to build your first or 500th guitar, including saws, fret files, high-end chisels, and more. Go to leevalley.com and tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and today I have the lucky job of talking to John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I've talked to John before. I interviewed him for our Steve Martin cover story back in the Fretboard Journal 30. That time was a lot of fun, and this time we actually get to have him on our podcast, which is even more fun because he is such a great storyteller. We also have a great video of John playing over on fretboardjournal.com. You can see him talking about his tunings and performing his tune, Brooklyn Crossing, on a very unique guitar, a Smooth Talker guitar. I don't know if you have seen these, but I had never seen one in the flesh before. It is an instrument you kind of have to see to believe. It looks nothing like a traditional guitar. They're from South Africa, and John loves his, so check out that video and poke around, learn about Smooth Talkers. I know I hadn't seen them before. I will preface, this conversation took place at a hotel in SeaTac, a hotel lobby. SeaTac is, of course, the airport town located midway between Seattle and Tacoma. Robin Hitchcock made it famous in a song recently. The hotel didn't want to let us have a private room without charging me gobs of money as though we were throwing a wedding or something. So we did the interview in the hotel lobby, and you're going to hear a little bit of noise because of that. I apologize for that. You might hear some squeaky luggage carts behind our conversation, but I hope it's not too obtrusive. The Fretboard Journal's 43rd issue is just a few weeks away from mailing. If you are a subscriber, thank you. If you have not subscribed to our magazine yet, please do so now, and you will get that issue before anyone else. You can use the coupon code podcast, and I will take $5 off of your order just for listening to this podcast. Right now, for a limited time, we are offering 3-year domestic subscriptions for just $99, which is a heck of a deal, especially if you use that podcast coupon code. We also have 1- and 2-year subscription deals and a lot more. Our new electric guitar annual has been selling great. It's almost close to being sold out. So if you haven't bought one yet, please hurry up on that. I don't want you to miss out on a copy by procrastinating. We are a small business and a reader-supported magazine, so subscriptions are truly the best way to show us your support. They also let us grow, and I have all sorts of crazy plans for growing in 2018 and 2019, including some new podcast shows and series and some new video series. So go over to fretboardjournal.com and help us out. If you are not into paper goods, if you do not like clutter, we just recently started offering all of our single issues, including that electric guitar annual, as a digital download PDF. So you can get PDFs of the issues if you want to help us out but don't want to actually have a bookshelf full of magazines. Maybe you don't even have a bookshelf. I don't know. While you're at fretboardjournal.com, we do have some cool new content you should know about, including some video clips of one of the earliest Leo Fender-built amplifiers in existence. That is an instrument that we featured in the Electric Guitar Annual. And we also have some outtake photos from our Rycooter feature and a lot more. If you have listened to the Fretboard Journal podcast, I'm guessing you know all about Loudon Guitars. They've been at it forever, and they are now sponsoring our podcast. In 1974, George Loudon made his first acoustic guitar, and shortly after that, he built 4 electrics, and then he stopped. But guess what? He's back. He's building electrics again. The new Loudon GL10 is a single-cut mahogany guitar with Lawler Imperial pickups, and that trademark Loudon aesthetic, it looks amazing. Check it out and read up on all their acoustic guitar offerings at loudonguitars.com. Our final sponsor is, of course, our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood now of New York City. Retrofret is one of my favorite vintage instrument stores, and if you check out their inventory, I think you might think it's one of yours as well. They recently landed a 1929 National Style 1 Tricone Square Neck. They've got a pair of vintage Fender Princetons, a 62 and a 64 Princeton Reverb. They also have a very cool, affordable arch top, a Sonata professional arch top, which was made by Harmony probably in the 40s. If you want a vintage arch top for under a grand, I think that's your ticket. They also do top-notch repair and restoration work. So go to retrofret.com and by all means tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. All right, you've waited long enough. Here is our talk with John McEwen, the legendary John McEwen, such a great storyteller. Next week, I believe I'm going to be talking to another great storyteller, singer-songwriter slash guitar wizard, David Wilcox, on this podcast. As always, if you have any requests for folks you want me to interview, things you want me to do, things you want me to change, reach out to me, jason@fretboardjournal.com. And please, if you like our podcast, don't forget to review it over on Apple Podcasts. Yeah, we're ready. I'm rolling. That was great.
Oh, thank you.
So, John, you brought a couple of interesting instruments here. I imagine this just barely scratches the surface of what you own, but...
Well, I have some guitars, banjos, mandolins, fiddles, a lap guitar, a keyboard, a couple dulcimers, like that.
Yeah. You mentioned you moved to Florida 5 years ago. Was there some downsizing when that took place, or did you keep everything?
It was upsizing. I went from 1,400 square feet in New York to 5,000 square feet in Florida.
Nice.
I have a studio in my basement that is where I do my XM satellite radio show, the Sirius XM show that I've had for 10 years called Acoustic Traveler. And I use my equipment. I don't have a great studio,
yeah,
but it's good stuff. It's Pro Tools HD.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of editing with it.
As we hear weird audio in the background. What?
Who is that?
An old shopping cart?
Luggage cart?
A lot of bottled water.
Okay. What does it entail to actually run that show out of your house? I mean, do you have a full, like, little
my
mini
show,
radio station?
It's voice tracks, yeah, talking about music that's coming up. The music I play is only people I know, yeah, that I've recorded with or that I've sat in with, because I don't know everybody I've sat in with.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you'll run across, and I'll say, hey, give me a CD, and I'll put some, or street performers. I put on about at least four or five street performers that I pick up their CD, one in Canada, one in Boston, L.A., different places, you know.
Yeah.
And it's really fun to be able to tell somebody that this CD of yours is going to be heard by about 400,000 or 500,000 people.
It's amazing.
And not that it means anything. It doesn't break them out or what, but it's just, those are the hard workers out there, those street performers.
Yeah.
And the buskers are, anyway, so it's people like that, or it's tapes that I've made. Like I got a couple cuts that I recorded with Leon Russell in his basement in 2004 or so. And then when I did, when he invited me to a studio in Oklahoma, 76, we did a song that ended up on the Dirt Band record. And I have recordings that I've done archivally, like Kenny Loggins at 19 before anybody had heard
him. Wow.
I have the first recording of Just Not My Cross to Bear by a 20-year-old Greg Allman the week he wrote it. Just him on piano, mm-hmm, and Larry Sims and Merle Briganti on bass and drums. And they later became the rhythm section for Loggins and Messina for 8 years.
Yeah.
Merle, I've known since I was 16, 17. And anyway, so it's a collection of weird tapes and songs and artists. And Hans Olsen in Phoenix is one of the best. He became what he was emulating. Mm-hmm. You've heard of Brownie and Sonny.
Sure.
Brownie McGee and Sonny Terrius, who I'm referencing, folks. Well, blues legends great. Sonny was a harp player, Brownie guitar. And Hans would go out. Brownie had trouble with the guitar sometimes, so Hans would play his guitar parts and Brownie would sing. Sonny had trouble with the harp sometimes, so Hans would play the harp. And Sonny would sing and Brownie would sing. Hans plays harp and guitar at the same time. He's in Phoenix. He won't travel. My name is Hans Olsen, and it rhymes with chance. He's got some of the best blues and original songs. He's just absolutely great. So I usually play him at least every other show.
Yeah. Were you able to see Sonny and Brownie and at the Ash Grove or anywhere when you were growing up? Or
we opened for Sonny and Brownie at the Troubadour for a week.
Okay.
They're the young Nitty Gritty Dirt Band in 1966 or 7, late 66 or 7. And that was really fun. We're down there rehearsing a song, and Sonny was up in the dressing room, and we couldn't figure out how to end the song, really. We get up to the dressing room, and Sonny's rocking back and forth in his chair with his harmonica. Wah, 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 wah. He goes, "Boys, let me tell you something about music. Wah, 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 wah. Yeah, well, the people, they got to know when it starts so they know when to listen. Wah, 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 wah. And then you got to let them know when it's over so they know when to clap. Wah. And in the middle, that's where you do the messing around. But make sure they know it's over."
Wow.
It's such a great... Yeah. Otherwise, they don't know it's the end.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen the evidence of that not being a good idea with songs that just kind of trail off.
Of course.
And people sit there and go, huh?
Yeah, yeah. They fade out on the record, but live you never can tell sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was it about... I know you've written... It feels weird to ask you about your history when you've written a whole book on it, which people
no,
should
it's fine.
Check out.
I couldn't get it all in the book. Really, this was like... I had a 900-page book. I had to cut down... I wanted to cut down to like 330.
Yeah.
I mean, so what was your question?
No, my question was just like... there. You were part of this pivotal Southern California moment of music. And, you know, I've talked to a bunch of people, Jackson Browne and Steve Martin and David Lindley and all these folks, and everyone seemed to have sort of a different entree point into American music and folk music. What was it for you? What got you smitten with roots music or whatever it was called back then?
There's an obvious separation of the cultural strata of the time. The Vietnam War helped create that, of course.
Yeah.
And I was in Southern California. And things were changing. There was new music coming along, and people were gravitating towards it, and there was a lot of younger people in L.A. So you found out, if you go look at the numbers, that between the ages of 15 and 22 years old, there's such an enormous amount of productivity and creativity from that age group, from Hang On Sloopy,
yeah,
being an early one. He was 16, I think, when he recorded that. Even O'Donna was, Richie Valens was 16, 17.
Yeah.
But the Byrds, 18, 19, 22.
Yeah.
You know, all those people, of which I'm proud to have been one of them, Jackson Browne, when I first heard Jackson Browne sing a new song, it was, And Jackson Browne, for instance, he was hanging around. He got in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band situation for a few months. He did four or five shows, but he didn't want to be in a band. That's when Les Thompson called me and said, "Hey, come join this new band." And but I was at that club one night where we were playing, and Jackson was going to go on too, but he was out in the outside, and he comes in the dressing room. Well, it wasn't much of a dressing room in 1966.
Sure.
And, "Hey, John, listen to this song." And he plays me a song, and I go, "That's a cool song, Jackson. Where'd you learn that?" He goes, "Oh, I just finished it." "Oh, you just finished learning it?" "No, I wrote it." I said, "Well, where'd you get the words?"
Yeah, yeah.
"And why is that funny chord in there?" He's playing an F major 7th instead of an F.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good idea for the guitar, because the F chord is one of the stupidest chords put on it. It takes you 10 years to be able to play a clean F chord.
Yeah.
You know, but he was making it easy. And the song was...
Yeah, these days.
Yeah. "Well, I've been out walking these days." It just sounded cool. "These days." And he went on stage and did it that night, and it just blew people away.
Yeah.
And Pat Paulson, the comedian, was our opening act in those days. He was a house painter in Orange County, California.
Wow.
You know, Steve Martin. We were working in the Disneyland Magic Shop before music came along.
Yeah.
And then along came the banjo. And
what got you into the banjo specifically?
Seeing a group called the Dillards. And Doug Dillard walked up on stage and kicked off Hickory Hollow at computer speed that was just lightning fast. But he did it with such a happiness and glee is one word that comes to mind.
Yeah.
And he was hardly ever looking at the instrument, scanning the audience. And he had them locked in. And the Dillards became my life for a couple of years.
Where was that first show?
Orange County, California, where I was living.
Yeah.
And Garden Grove, actually. And I go see them at various clubs, the Golden Bear, the Troubadour, the Ash Grove, Ice House in Glendale, Ice House in Pasadena, the Mecca in Buena Park.
Yeah,
that's what the scene was like. There were these clubs all over that people were gravitating to, and it never has gotten enough credit like Greenwich Village it does.
Yeah.
Ooh, Greenwich Village. Greenwich Village, people could hang around within blocks.
Yeah.
L.A. was like, I'm going to run up to the Troubadour.
Yeah.
And it'd be 25 minutes. Of course, now it's 45.
Yeah, a little longer.
For 50 minutes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they named that freeway the 405 because you go 4 or 5 miles an hour. And so there was shows going on of all these new groups. And the Birds would be playing at a Gazzari's or the Whiskey. Or just, for example, the Association would show up. The Doors. The Doors would play high schools and colleges like we all did in the afternoons.
Mm-hmm.
To pick up $600, $700, $800.
Yeah.
That was like 66, 67.
Yeah.
And it was such a nascent, as they say in print, business that one of the shows we did was at Birmingham High School that had the Buffalo Springfield, the Association, the Birds, the Jefferson Airplane, and the Doors, Jefferson Airplane and the Doors, and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Pretty now, good from, lineup.
Yeah, $6 to get in too. How they can charge? But it was 12,000 people on this football field, and it was like shocking to the people in the business to think that hey, this music could draw a lot of people.
Yeah,
you know, White Rabbit was just barely on the radio, and things like that. Buy From Me the Rain had just been our first hit, and it was doing well. That concert was in May of '67. And it's just times were different. You mixed them all up. That audience, I wish I had a picture of it, you know, because you had the beehive hairdos and you had paisley hippies and you...
What a melting pot, yeah.
It was the whole... The Valley Girls and the Beach Bums and the surfers and everybody going to hear that radio music.
So what... After hearing the Dillards, you somehow procured a banjo. Were you totally self-taught?
Generally, I would spend a lot of time watching the Dillards play, usually 2 days a week.
Okay. It's good training.
And hanging out in the dressing room, finally.
Yeah.
And Doug, one time, he looked at me and he went, well, he's walking upstairs, he didn't say anything. He just went, after him. Doug looked at me with a grin and took his banjo and... And I never heard lead on the fourth string like that.
Yeah.
I said, Doug, I've never heard you play that before. What was that? He goes, J.D. Crowe, plays with Jimmy Martin. Go check him out.
Yeah.
Next day, I bought me a Jimmy Martin album and found out about J.D. Crowe. It's like, oh, my God, that guy is good. You know? And he would show me other things. Like, he would do this lick a lot. I said, that's not like your other stuff. He goes, Bill Keith, go check him out.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a gateway to many things.
Yeah.
He was also a gateway to showing me one path to not go down, and that was the path of drugs and drinking.
Sure.
I never was interested in drinking. for some reason, and the drug world never appealed to me, and I watched his playing deteriorate to practically nothing and got mad at him for it. Doug had his problems in life. He had a lot of pain in the last part of his life from a fall off of a movie set on the movie Popeye.
Wow.
And he was taking prescribed painkillers. But before then, like, it's not like an accusation or anything, but yeah, he was basically sampling the pharmaceutical field.
Got it.
You know, it was that was the times.
Yeah.
And it made me realize it doesn't matter how good you are, the drugs are going to screw you up.
Yeah.
They will do something. That's why you take them. Mm-hmm. That's why people take them.
Yeah.
You don't take an aspirin without expecting it to kill the headache a little bit. Mm-hmm. But what people don't realize is when you take that I don't want to be a preacher here. I never got into it.
You're a survivor. It's a testament. You're still at it, you know?
Maybe that's it. I mean, some of the people that were trying to get me to do coke are dead from coke overdose.
Sure.
Toy Caldwell. The Caldwell Brothers. Yeah. Marshall Tucker album I played on. He was really, come on, John, let's do a toot. And I said, no, Toy, I'm a little busy. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, we okay with that?
We're okay with that. There's always a little ambient noise on the podcast. Talk to me about this new record that you did with one microphone. This is kind of a wild concept for me. I mean, you always see the old bluegrass bands huddled around one microphone, but this doesn't sound like that kind of microphone.
This was a different situation. Chesky Records has been known in the jazz and classical world for making the highest quality sounding recordings. They've made over 400 albums. Norman Chesky approached me and said, I want to do an album with you. It proceeded to, a year later, finally getting done. I had to, well, can't I wear headphones? No, you can't wear headphones. Well, how about little monitor speakers so I can hear the snare drum? No, no monitoring. Here's the deal. If somebody's playing a solo and you can't hear them, you're playing too loud.
Okay.
Listen to them.
Yeah.
Back them up. And everybody would gather around this microphone with the mics loaded into the head dummy head named Lars. And the engineer would come out after running a song once. Okay, background vocals, you need to come in a little closer. Let's move the fiddle back, and we'll move the flute, the penny whistle over to the left. Go to the noon position instead of 3 o'clock. You know, and then when you play it back, my people were they weren't skeptical, because I have a good reputation of not putting people in bad situations. Although it was about 60 or 58 degrees in this old church in Brooklyn where it was recorded the first day. Everybody's wearing jackets and everything.
Yeah.
But what heated them up, we laid down that first song and everybody went and listened with the headphones and went, oh my God. It sounds like we're out there playing right now.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm, and it's a surround sound without surround sound. Because you know how you can say, I dropped my car keys, you hear them behind you?
Yeah.
There's a bird chirping up in a tree. There's a jet flying from in front of you to over your head to behind you.
Yeah.
You hear things off in the distance that are, well, that's how you hear. A stereo record is right to left.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, that's it. You got your right side, left side, middle, it's mixed like that. But that's not how you hear.
Mm-hmm.
And the people at Princeton that developed this mic for Chesky, they understand that top end comes in from behind you and it hits your ear channels, your ear shape, a certain way to tell you that it's behind you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or in front of you or down on the ground or up in the air. And they've been able to reproduce that. My daughter called me. I'd sent her the album when it first came out. And she goes, Dad, I'm home alone. I wish you would have told me about this album. I'm home alone, and I thought somebody came in behind me. Scared me. Because, like,
but the mic is literally like a dummy head?
Yeah, it's mounted on a dummy head.
Okay,
and
which you named
play
Lars.
To that.
Yeah.
And I was very skeptical. The drums on this one cut, it's not heavy. This is Americana music. It's bluegrass influence. Warren Zevon song, a William Blake poem that I wrote music for called I Rose Up. I was very skeptical.
Yeah.
People singing live and all that. That I was skeptical that the drums would get picked up. But on this one song, Miner's Night Out, where the drum part is fairly orchestrated, I couldn't believe how that kick drum sounded so warm. And the snare, it's a marching kind of thing. And it didn't dominate. And it filled the room. They put it in the perfect spot because the echo was about a, it was almost a 2 second echo. From, like, that's very quick. But the this old church had a great echo. Echo, no effects on this.
Yeah.
The mic and the people had to do it. And I have some great instruments. That, and so does Dave Bromberg.
Yeah.
He brought a bunch of stuff. And Andy Gessling from Railroad Earth. Do you know that name?
I know Railroad Earth, yeah.
Andy's the genius multi-instrumentalist in that band. John Carter Cash. I wanted him to do one of his dad's songs. I Still Miss Someone. And David Amram. Do you know that name?
No, I do
not. Well, if you Google David Amram and intend to read about him, it'll take a while.
Yeah.
He is 86 years old, and he went to Cuba with Dizzy Gillespie. He's 86 years old, and he went to Cuba with Dizzy Gillespie in 1956. He was Jack Kerouac's traveling buddy.
Wow.
His music has been conducted by Leonard Bernstein at Carnegie Hall. He was a composer in residence at Carnegie for a couple of years. He was at Pete Seeger's deathbed.
Yeah.
He sat in with Willie Nelson and me. I mean, David Amram is the oldest teenager you'll ever meet.
Wow.
He's just such a kick. He plays tin whistle, percussion, piano, and various East Indian instruments, and he plays percussion and penny whistle on this album.
Yeah.
And he just adds a flavor that only he can do. And Jay Unger, fiddle player.
Sure.
The Shokan Farewell guy. I've wanted to record with all these people for years. John Cowan from, you might recognize his name from Newgrass Revival.
Sure.
I had a song I've been trying to get the Dirt Band to record for 20 years. That's the nitty-gritty Dirt Band situation for me, is in succinctly. After 50 years, I realized that we weren't partners, brothers, nor friends, as one of the songs said. And that was a sad thing, because I couldn't sell my own CDs on the merchandise table at a show. I'd never recorded any of my music. Tried a couple times to work something up. Never lasted more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Ah, this isn't going to work. This is boring. Whatever. You know. A long list of things, wouldn't take any ideas on things, and it was just a working with a blank wall. Did the same set for 12 years.
Sure.
And things like that. And what was my point about that? It was time to go.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah, and this song was an example. She Dark the Sun was written by my friend Bernie Ledden in the days when we were hanging out in 1968, before he started the Eagles with the other guys. And 68, they hadn't come along yet, and he wrote this very cool song with can't remember the other guy, one of those bird guys. Mm-hmm. And it kills on stage.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to sing. And John Cowan knocks it out of the park.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, Jason, it was so powerful to be in a room around one mic and everybody going, okay, this is, let's take it. We're ready.
Yeah.
It was one take.
Yeah.
And it was like the old days. It must have been exciting to be in the Sinatra sessions or some of that Elvis stuff. And it was that same, it was like the Circle Be Unbroken album.
Yeah.
Only there we did several takes on some songs. But everybody was, that energy was going into that. And what was really weird is 3, 4, 5 minutes later, you're done. Okay, well, and usually what would happen, okay, do you have anything you have to fix? Okay, the guitar's okay. Oh, you got to go fix that kick drum on that one. Oh, you got to go fix, you know, you go in and do your fixes in a normal multi-track situation. There were no fixes.
Yeah.
This is the way it is.
That sounds intoxicating. Do you want to?
Oh my God.
Is the opportunity to do this again?
It was as close to the live show feeling
that
you could get recording. And yes, it was intoxicating. I mean, we did 14 cuts in 2 days.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to leave.
Can you do it again? Is there an open invite from Chesky and the $100,000 microphone?
Or? There is, but it's putting it together is an arduous situation, and I hope there is a time, because I'll say, in spite of the accolades and the great reviews, it hasn't sold. If it had sold 30,000 albums, I'd be in the middle of doing it again. Right now, we're still trying to get it out there. You know, I couldn't get better reviews. I mean, I got an email last night from a guy that bought one of these. He says, I got it. It arrived. I've been listening to it ever since. You were right. You know, thank you.
Did it come out on vinyl too?
It's on vinyl too.
And what's your preferred way to listen to it? Vinyl or the CD, or I'm guessing not Spotify.
I like to listen to things in all the different formats.
Yeah.
I don't use earbuds, but headphones. Every now and then, speakers at home, my computer speakers. Even on the phone, I love listening to this because I can hear the bass on the phone.
Yeah, all right.
You know, maybe it's because I know the bass part, but it's good for any, you can listen to it anywhere.
Yeah.
Sounds like that. Miracle drug, right?
Snake
oil. Yeah.
No.
Listen to music, you can listen to it anywhere. Listen to it in the shower, you can listen to it in the car.
I know you have to run, but I'm just curious. I know you're doing this string of West Coast dates and you're off to your next gig. What does the current lineup look like at your live shows? What are you doing? What are you playing?
I've been taking out the original Dirt Band bass player, the guy that called me, Les Thompson, a fine man that was there the first 10 years. He's on bass and vocals. And Matt Cartsonis, who played with Warren Zevon and various people over the years, and is a great writer, funny guy, wonderful performer, mandola and guitar. His vocals are always bring the house down. And in the 70s, when Nitty Gritty Dirt Band became the first American group to go to Russia, we did 28 sold-out shows. Well, in the 70s, there was a guy named John Cable in the band, and he's out playing with us. So I got three Dirt Band members on stage.
Great.
Three alumni.
Yeah.
And John Cable has some new music. We did his song last night at the Triple Door in Seattle. It was one of those songs that it went over, the applause didn't stop. It kind of died down and then started up again. A wonderful to get the new music out there. And I think one of the highest compliments I've had in the last couple of weeks, I've had it said in various parts of the country that this was a most fun night I've had in 10, 20 years. And, you know, the new music, I really liked it. Yeah. And you kind of wait through the new stuff and to get and I go, well, that is the best thing I've heard.
Yeah.
The new songs, some of them are off of the Made in Brooklyn album. The new music is going over like the hits. So that's pretty cool.
That's great.
And so I got to get going because I might make it big sometime, and I'm trying to work on that.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you, John. This was great.
Well, like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.